Ladies and gentlemen, it's a very great honour and privilege for us to have with us Boris Fyodorov. As you know, he's one of the truly great members of the reforming side in Russia. Last year, he was the finance minister of Russia, and also 2 years before that. But last year, he almost single-handedly brought Russia back from the verge of hyperinflation. He pushed through major reforms in the direction of liberalized markets, and he certainly is one of the main forces now that is pushing for reform in Russia. He left the government in January, and he's now very active in the Duma. We hope he'll soon be very active again if the right conditions come to pass in the government. Obviously, for us, the timing could not have been better. Maybe it could not have been worse for Boris, I don't know. But it is a great honour, Boris, that you decided to stay with us at this time of turmoil in Russia. We really appreciate it. I should say that the original timing was quite different. The original timing was because when Boris was a member of the EBRD staff, 2 years ago, we discussed how the LSE could be most helpful to Russia, and he said train some bankers. And now, with the help of the Know-How Fund and the Soros Foundations, we have just last week started a course for 30 Russians in banking and finance, which owes a great deal to Boris's suggestion and support. So we're very grateful for that, but even more grateful that you are here today.
Well, it's a pleasure to address you, although I'm a little bit daunted by the task of talking to real economists, because we in Russia, at least when I was in the college, were not really studying economics. We were pretending of studying something which we preferred to forget about that. And I've been just to the book store here, and all the titles seemed so serious that the only one which I really liked was the about the alchemy of finance by Soros.
Oh, right.
Well, that I more or less understand. And the second one, which should be probably very interesting, it was called something like Monetary and Fiscal Policy, Part 1, Credibility. And I think that's the key word for any economic policy. And that's exactly that is lacking in Russia today, because despite all the talk about reforms and the starting point for many people was not actually in 91 or in 90, but in 85, when Mr. Gorbachev first came, and a lot of us decided that the time has come for real changes. And it's already 10 years, and it's amazing how fast the time was running and how big are the changes which occurred in our country, and at the same time how little was actually achieved if you look at the reform process seriously, if you take different parts of the reform process. We still have a very weak understanding what actually the reforms mean compared to Eastern Europe, compared even to some countries like some of the Baltic states, in the sense that in Russia it was never a very clean break with the past. It's absolutely clear that we had a transition where a lot of things were happening which could be best described by just political fight, where democracy was pronounced but not always followed, and it's a very nice track record of several years with two parliaments dismissed, one president kicked out, and still waiting for a peaceful transfer of power. And despite that, most of the world thinks we're very democratic. it's clear that the understanding of economic reforms is and was very weak. Even at the days of Gaidar's government in 92, the actual composition of the government was very strange, because there were a lot of people who are still in the government. There were a lot of people who were in the government for a long time before that, and who probably will be in some governments, whether it is a communist prime minister or a Zhirinovsky prime minister or somebody else. And it's absolutely clear that one of the weaknesses of this political and economic reform process was that we thought that it's possible to be hired guns for politicians trying to implement economic reforms without changing the political scenery. And it's now clear to most people that this approach failed, that this approach led to the very peculiar picture where reformers were and still are window dressing for people who are not so much interested in reforms. Even with Mr. Gaidar's government, probably 5% of the government was reformist. Today, I'm asked, why are you saying that there are more communists in Russian government than in the parliament? I mean, proportionally. Well, and I always answer, name me one who is not a communist aside from Mr. Chubais. And people start thinking, and well, they finally agree that probably, yes, that's something. By communist, I don't mean a communist, a member of some party. Because it's not that, it's just how you view democracy, how you view economics, how you view the role of the government, and how you view the future of Russia. And it's clear that we never had a comprehensive reform package where in certain areas like privatization and financial policy, there were steps implemented which could be considered reform. And there were a lot of concrete measures in these areas which were in the right direction, in my opinion. But at the same time, we had a situation where, for instance, in agriculture, it's clear that the reform process is nowhere. It's nowhere because agriculture is getting more and more subsidies from the state and producing less and less. Agriculture, which is producing at world prices products, and at the same time, the wages of the people are, let's say, $20 per month. And energy costs are 30% of the world level. You understand that, well, at least in the Marxist economics, it was considered that productivity is low. And it's clear that it's very low, and that competitiveness is nowhere. And nobody wants to think about it. In the Russian government, the word productivity, efficiency, was never really mentioned. And all the industrialists which were priding themselves on their pragmatic approach, although I always ask, why McDonald's in Moscow is not hiring people who were working in Russian restaurants or canteens? They were very experienced. Why it is considered that a person who was a minister of something during the Soviet period is very experienced to be a minister in market environment? And it is considered like that. And it's not considered only in Russia. We have a lot of Western sympathizers who think the same, who are absolutely ravenous about how practical, for instance, is the current prime minister. And of course he is very practical. He knows everything about Gazprom, and I would like to know as much as he knows what really happens in Gazprom and who owns it today. That would be very interesting to learn. The question is that the bricks of the reform process are being laid in a very lopsided fashion. Let's say we take the social sphere. It's clear that the priorities in this sphere were never properly defined, and that's the mistake of the reformers, and that's the biggest mistake of the current government. Because it's not the question of how much money you spend, or at least not only this problem exists. It's the question that the system is a remnant of the past, it's not being reformed, it's wasting money, it's not reaching the needy, it's not reaching the weak. The billionaire is getting the same benefits as a pauper who is out of job for several years. And it's clear that something is wrong. The unemployment benefit system became a financial casino where in lots of regions the funds which were supposed to help to retrain people and to create jobs are playing on the financial markets. Well, it's not bad because people at least get educated and they make some money. That helps at least some people. But it's clear that that's not the task of the social security system. Or you take the very simple thing like housing problem. Somehow everybody forgot that in Russia there are millions of people who are still living in communal flats. And in some countries people just don't know what it is. And I explain, it's not when students share an apartment. It's when families with children share the same flat. In one room, there is one family, in the second room is the second family, in the third room is the third family, and then they share the same bathroom, the same kitchen, they share everything. And there are millions of people like this. And nobody is talking about it, and the problem is not addressed. And at the same time, we have a situation where in the presidential administration, there are 40,000 people who are servicing the system of dachas, rest houses, hunting grounds, medical facilities for the elite. 40,000 people. You know how many people work in Western bank, in foreign banks in London? It's about the same number. In several hundreds banks, the same number of people. And it's just servicing one part of the system. I wouldn't talk how many bodyguards our president has. That's another item which is classified. I cannot talk about it. That's why he cannot get awake sometimes. There are too many of them. You cannot just go through. And then you look at the number of bureaucrats. And one member of the Moscow government, the Moscow city government, told me that the number of Moscow city bureaucrats increased fourfold over 5 years. And the number of Russian bureaucrats increased twofold compared to the Soviet period when in Moscow there was Russian government, Union Central Committee, trade unions, and a lot of other organizations which were utilizing a lot of buildings. There's no space, even in the White House, which was taken by the government. And in which country the government has a special government house where there are several thousand people? It's not ministries. It's nothing like that. It's departments which overshadow and overlap with the ministries. And then, of course, in the presidential administration, there are special departments which overlap with the government departments. And this overlapping process goes for so long that the paper which is sent to the government disappears for months. Not always found. It's actually very useful sometimes. You understand that there is an opposition to a certain decision. You just send it to be reconciled with all the possible departments. Unless you send a pretty girl with the paper, with a strict order to do it in one day, it will never return. So you send these papers and they never return, and the process goes on. And the government, which works like this, obviously is not efficient. The government like this is still thinking that the old system is there. They did not realize that the market economy is around, that the task of the government is to regulate, not to manage the economy, is to create the rules of the game and to protect taxpayers and not to trade in their own name and not to produce anything, not to continue distributing material and financial assets in a very funny way. Or the question of the finances. Obviously, financial policy is a crucial point where everything is getting in one place. And the biggest problem last year and this year and probably next year was and is that nobody considers budget a law. Nobody considers decision of the parliament or even of the government that so much money is spent on on this and that. There are lots of orders where you are made to spend money on something which is not in the budget. And when you are telling president and prime minister that this is not civilized, that you cannot just spend money like you're a monarch. Not a British monarch, because here it is a civilized system. And people don't understand, because they think that being in the government means that you can do whatever you wish. You can spend whatever money you wish, you can print whatever money you wish, in however big amounts. And this is a very big problem. Second, the politics interfere in the finances so much. When several parts of Russia are not paying properly taxes for several years, and nobody pays attention. Well, Minister of Finance is paying attention and is fighting, but it's never, and there were several proposals last year on how you end this process. And this year was the same story. But politically, nobody wants to make enemies of the regions. And they think that if they give more political benefits and deferrals and tax breaks, that these regions will respect the center more. Well, my experience is that in Russia, nobody respects very weak people. And the more you give, the less you are respected, and the less power is in Moscow. And this is a major problem for the future, because when the central government is getting weak, and there is degradation and mediocrity of power, this is a very serious problem for the whole country, for the stability of the country, for the integrity of the country. Because when you have a situation like in Chechen Republic, for 3 years there is a military fighting with very noticeable criminal undertones. And it's absolutely clear that these people are Russian citizens. Nobody has made a decision that people in Chechen Republic are not Russian citizens. And the Russian authorities are pretending that they don't notice it. Or they're saying, well, that's not our business. We shall wait for the solution. Or the upper chamber of the parliament is making appeals to the elder people of the Chechen nation, stop killing each other. The younger people of the Chechen nation, stop killing each other. Where are the authorities? People are killing each other and the authorities are appealing. They're not doing anything. And it costs a lot. Or the situation with the borders, when we have invented a very funny notion of a far abroad and near abroad. What is far abroad and what is near abroad if it is abroad? If it is abroad, there should be borders. If you don't have a political and economic union with these countries, it should be real borders. There should be customs officials, there should be border guards, should be checking the visas, like the British do, careful, in Heathrow. If you're not checking the visas, well, probably some criminals are coming into the country. And then we have criminals, we have to fight them. And when you fight them by issuing from time to time decrees, and then you go around, and there was a TV program, people being asked from the police, have you heard about this decree? Did it help you? Half of them didn't really hear anything about it. And the second half said, well, so what? It didn't help us any. And that's clear that this is a very big economic issue, because when Estonia becomes one of the big exporters of certain metals, which we never mined there, and we don't see the upsurge in the custom duties coming from the exports of these metals to Estonia, something is wrong. And the government is losing so much money that I will reiterate wherever possible that we don't really need any loans from IMF. We just need to put the house in order. And I was telling it, Mr. Kamdasyu, last year many times, that money doesn't matter. $1 or $2 billion in Russian terms is nothing. Just a joke. We can economize much more if we were just a little bit more disciplined, there was a little bit more of law and order from the top to the down, where people would be just implementing the existing decisions and not adopting the decisions which are not implementable. When each police officer in Russia, by law, is authorized to get a subsidized loan, and then you multiply the number of police by the number of loans and the amounts, and you understand that the banking system will go bust if each policeman will come to get this cheap loan. How can you take such decisions? Or We have a law on grain, which was a very funny law, that if you grow some wheat in a flower pot on your windowsill, you're supposed to get a subsidy from the government. There was a decision on cattle houses. If you build a cattle house for more than 6 cows, you're compensated 50% of the cost. I think only a stupid person wouldn't build a cow house which will be used differently after cows were there for 3 minutes after the completion. If such laws, such stupid laws are taken, and when we read thousands of the government decisions which are not on economic policy, it's very, very frightening sometimes. At the same time, it's clear that the economic activity which is not directly related to the government is there. More and more people are not working for the state. And you walk in a Russian bank in Moscow now, bank like Stolichny or Most or Menatep or others, and you don't really realize that you're in Moscow, because they now look like Western banks. They still hate Western banks because they don't want to share the cream that they're getting from the market. But it's clear that in many quarters there are many more people now who have something to lose, who understand the situation much better, and who are very worried. When we see the current proposals of the Russian government on taxes, which actually increase the tax burden, well, people are worried, because for several years we are talking about the excessive tax burden, about the very strange systems where, for instance, the exchange rate is falling, and the difference in the valuation of your, let's say, dollar holdings last year and this year is considered profit. And there's no indexation of capital gains. And you understand, when the exchange rate falls, I don't know, 3 times, 4 times, and so on, it could be a very nice paper profit. And if you really pay tax on it, you're bust. Or the excessive wages. Excessive wage is 6 times more than the minimum wage, and it's around 120,000 rubles. So even if the exchange rate is 3,000, it's just about $40. So this is the excessive wage. It's too high. And government is trying to regulate to a major degree, and that was a fight last year and this year. A lot of people in the government still think that to fight inflation, you have to control, first of all, wages. Not the money supply, not the credits from the central bank, not the how budget deficit is financed, but you just control wages and everything will be fine. It's a pure Stalinist proposal, because that was one part of the financial system over 40 years, where cash money was different from cashless money, from the book entry money. You couldn't use money which was for wages, you couldn't use it for capital investment. And still a lot of people thinking like this. And it's clear that nobody who has any brains in the financial sense is not paying this tax. Because it's so simple. You go to any financial advisor, they will give you 1,000 ways how not to pay it. So only the industrialists who are not really wise in the ways of this world are paying it. So why have this tax if it's so easily avoidable? You give each officer in the bank a loan and they get their wages in the way of interest. And interest is not chargeable. So, and everybody knows it, and everybody plays with it. And then we pretend that this is a tax system. And other people pretend that they pay taxes. And everybody pretends that they're making reforms. And the West pays for it. So that's a nice equation, which probably should, at a certain point of time, be changed. I think that the current year showed that there were practically no economic policy measures which could be considered policy. And unfortunately, it's not clear what will happen now with all these events. I don't believe that Mr. Dubinin or Mr. Gerashenko were really to blame for the case on the financial markets. And to look for scapegoats instead of looking for real problems for the substance of the economic policy is a very wrong approach. If the investigation is conducted like I think it will be conducted, then probably we shall never really know what really happened, first. And second, the lessons will not be learned from this experience. But I'm at least happy that some attention was drawn to certain things, and probably there's still some chance that something good will happen out of it. The problem for the 95 is manifold. First, it's clear now that Russia will go into the next year with the same tax system. Probably a couple of really stupid things will be abolished, but it's clear that nobody will be in time to adopt a really new tax legislation. On the budget, it's clear today that nobody knows what the budget will be. This is not the news, it's all the time in Russia like this. But it's clear that with these events, we hear that in Moscow, in the government, people are drastically looking for ways of correcting the policy and having much tighter targets, and not to talk anymore about 5% inflation in December 95. And let's hope that something will happen that will give a chance for the current government to do something differently. It's clear that the enterprise reform, the restructuring of the enterprises, the industrial policy, is still at the zero stage. It's not only the number of bankruptcies, it's not only the number of officially registered unemployed, which this figure is so low, and everybody knows that at least 10 times higher in real terms, and a lot of people are just not working and pretending that they're not unemployed. And I've heard some directors saying, let's let our workers go for two years on holidays, but at least the collective of this plant will be preserved. And in 2 years, they will come back and they will start working. If such things happen, obviously nobody will come back and nobody will work. And it's clear that the low unemployment figure is a sham, and it's hiding a lot of issues which will come to the fore one day very, very unexpectedly. Because I've been to many enterprises recently, and it's clear that directors are afraid to take measures inside their enterprise, even if it is already a joint stock company, if it is already something different. And this is also a political issue. Without prodding from the government, it will not really happen. And one of the issues is corruption and how you look for the assets which are hidden. And the current investigation of the government into the oil sector will be indicative of something. If it helps to find a few trillion rubles, then again, there is a good sign and something will happen. But the biggest cheerful sign for me is that when you talk to Western investment bankers and you hear the figures mentioned, which were already spent buying shares on the market, even with very bad custody services, with very strange registrations, with very strange procedures on when you go to Siberia to look into the register and to see whether the certificate is really registered properly. But it looks like a couple of billion dollars this year already came into the country. Well, I personally met several people who are very serious about investing hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's a good sign, because the more is invested, the more joint ventures exist, the more outside directors are on the boards of joint stock companies, the more people are going through Mr. Laird's courses, the better are the chances that the situation will improve. Although I personally believe that only the next elections really can bring a drastic change, really can help us to have finally a clean break with the past. Otherwise, it will be still this strange situation where we move from one exchange of banknotes or monetary reform to a coup d'etat, from coup d'etat to the exchange rate fall, and in between it's pure mediocrity, lack of vision, lack of political will. But the country is very rich. Everybody will not emigrate. Lots of assets, very much undervalued. even if the exchange rate fell a little bit, still it's so much undervalued that in real terms, unless we have an iron curtain around Russia again, everything will have to appreciate probably hundreds of times. So, and that's very good for investors. It's very good for the country. And I think the really serious investors will disregard the current events and will have to make strategic decisions. Unfortunately, they will go now more for export-oriented sectors and will be very fearful of ruble sector in the economy. But we shall see what happens. And at least from the part of the parliament, I can assure that we shall make a fight for the future while the parliament is there, not dismissed yet. So there is still some chance. Thank you.
Questions? We can have some questions. Well, I think you can see from that how much Russia needs somebody like Boris Fyodorov in charge. Boris is willing to take some questions. Who would like to start?
Well, I disagree utterly to the idea of conspiracy because, first, I don't believe in conspiracy theories in principle. When I hear that many people say, well, all this collapse was invented by somebody. Somebody carefully planned it. And I always say, if somebody carefully planned all that happened in the last 5 years, I'm even more optimistic. It means that something is possible to plan in Russia. Well, but unfortunately, in this case, I disagree with this opinion. I think that's just the usual ploy of the Soviet bureaucracy. It always happened in the past. When there is a fire, when there is a scandal, when there is a crisis, you always find a scapegoat. And then you fire a couple of people and the issue is closed. And that's the problem. Instead of going to the root of the issue, instead of looking why this happened, and obviously the answer is in the field of the policies of the government, in this word with which I've started, the credibility of the economic policies. When markets stop believe in something, it's very difficult to stop them even if you inject a lot of dollars, even if you use all your reserves. And I think it would be a very bad precedent if even now, instead of acknowledging the problems, instead of starting to tackle these issues, we shall have just a couple of scapegoats, even if Mr. Gerashenko is my best friend. And obviously, I'm not so upset about the words of Mr. Yeltsin about him. Still, I sympathize him, because to be the last in the row and to be blamed for something where you are just one part of the process is unfair.
Tim? I have two questions.
Can you speak up?
You mentioned,
can you stand up and speak up?
Yeah, two questions. Firstly, you mentioned that, that there is increasing foreign investment. How much of this do you think is returning flight capital rather than genuine foreign investment? Secondly, you also mentioned a lack of confidence among foreign investors in the rural sector. There has been talk of pegging the ruble to a basket of hard currencies. Do you think this is likely and politically feasible?
Well, of course, there is a certain trend of return of the flight capital. Well, it's very difficult to estimate, and personally, I don't think it's more than like 10%. That's offhand estimate. But it's clear that a lot of Russian businessmen who are not satisfied with the rates of return in the West, with the interest rates in the West, with the very slow fluctuations in the West, I would like to go into Russia because well, you just put the money on the account, you could be probably getting, I don't know, 5% on dollars per month. Well, that's much better than here. So this trend exists. That's why most of the big banks lobby the question of the amnesty, lobby around parliament, around government, around central bank, for the schemes how you could entice more of this capital to return. And I don't see anything wrong with it, ultimately. Because you cannot really stop the flight by just administrative measures, by just jailing somebody, investigating, and so on. But the question is that it will not really happen on a major scale unless there is credibility, unless there is a belief among the businessmen that they can return safely, that they will not have to hide everything again, unless they believe that ruble will be more or less stable, that reforms will be going on. That's the crucial issue, and you understand that it's not really clear how it is going to be solved. And the second one was pegging. Well, personally, I don't like this idea. Actually, you know that the Soviet ruble was pegged to a basket of currencies. Well, since I worked in the State Bank of Israel, we had a special department, and there was a basket of, I don't know, five or six currencies and weights and so on. Although, of course, it didn't mean much, because it was like a very strange system for the balance. Current account of the country was the balance sheet of the Vnesheconom Bank, and they were managing the risk for that balance sheet. Today, I think the time probably for real pegging has gone, and I'm very much afraid that once you fix something in Russia, to unfix it later would be very difficult. That's why even if the economic theory says that something like that is possible and feasible and probably useful, I wouldn't advocate any freezes on prices, any freezes on wages, any freezes on the exchange rate, any pegging, because you never know what it will come to. And there is no really need. If you have normal policy, then the exchange rate will be more or less okay. Like last year, it was clear that since June until the events around the parliament, it was more or less stable, and it was clear that will be inflation will be going down. If we didn't have the exchange reform, the exchange of the banknotes in August, inflation would have been much lower by the end of the year, as it were. And there was no real need for that. And today, probably something like that could be done if there is one thing implemented, like total ban on the credits from the central bank to the budget. And I'm not sure that this is politically really feasible. At least in the law on central bank, which we still discuss in the parliament, in the version which was adopted in the first reading, there was this ban written in, despite disagreement of the central bank. Now they send amendments, and they again want to delete this. The central bank wants to give loans to the budget. This is crazy. It's unbelievable. But in Russia, it's like this. And we have to fight to put this in place and to explain. And of course, Mr. Gerashenko agrees, yes, theoretically, that's right, but we're not prepared. But unless you do this, then all this pegging business and all the decisions which are linked, for instance, to the IMF loans, they're useless. It will be a wastage of time. Because the current thinking is, let's borrow as much as possible, we shall fix the rate, but then nothing will happen. Political benefits will not be cancelled, the loans from the central bank will not be cancelled, and some other things will not happen. And then we shall have again the increased external debt, and then new and new rounds of negotiations, and then huge achievements on new deferrals, because obviously if somebody doesn't pay to you, well, you have to make it look nice. You call it a deferral. But this is not the future. If Russia is a country which considers itself to be one of G7 or G8 or whatever, it has to address certain issues in a different way. And so far, I don't see the political will to do it. Thank you.
Area of Russia's potential wealth yet to be mobilized. You talk about subsidies. Is that
Well, obviously there are experiments in Nizhny Novgorod and some other places which are more or less successful, but the problem of the land is obviously there, because you understand, when you rename all the collective farms and call them joint stock companies, nothing changes unless you solve the issue of the sale and purchases of land. And the fight about this is still coming, because, for instance, the civil code, which will be in the third reading very soon, probably one of these days, that's one of the parts which will be contested most severely. Because people in the agricultural lobby understand that once they lose on the free trade of land, they will lose everything. Second, the system of subsidies is so complex and so unprofessional and so corrupt that it could be, for instance, electricity in agricultural areas is subsidized by the increased prices for industry in the cities. For fertilizers, or for purchases of machinery, or for pesticides. Just several dozens, various types of subsidies, which, if collected, they present a very strange picture, where just you make a step and there is already some kind of subsidy because you've done something. And a lot of loans, which are not really loans, but hidden subsidies. And one of the mistakes of the current government was that in April they've reinstated basically the subsidized loans. We've cancelled them on 25th of September last year. But in April they've invented a system like, it's not really loans, it's not subsidized, it's through the budget. And basically it was the same. And a lot of this money is not reaching people. There is no linkage to productivity. There is a very strange mechanism of distribution of these subsidies, where the Ministry of Agriculture thrives on it. They don't want to allow anybody to know how it's done, why some people are getting, why some people are not getting. And to go after them, again, you have to have political will. And it's clear that to a major degree, things will depend on the property issues. For instance, one of the proposals I've heard in the regions, which struck me as probably a way to solve this issue in parts of Russia, is you just find in a kolkhoz one strong guy, help them buy the shares from the others, and create a landlord, and create what we call in Russian pomeshchik. I don't know how to translate it in the correct way in English. That's one way, and I've heard even more strange ways of dealing with agriculture, the zero option from very high official in one of the regions. We give them nothing, we expect nothing from them, we forget about them. Because when out of several hundred companies in agriculture, there is probably 5% viable, who will work in any case, whether aided by the government or not aided, there should be some drastic decisions. There should be a really very strong policy. That's why I always say, partly in joke, that Mr. Chubais should be agricultural minister.
Maybe we should.
Next year. Yeah, well, we shall offer it to him. He has to be very strong.
Yes, recently you wrote to the Financial Times saying that you'd like to see Russia get full membership of NATO. I wonder if you could say why that's important for Russia, and also how you see the organization developing if Russia did have full membership of it.
Well, the immediate reason to write this letter was the words of the German defense minister, which were publicized in Financial Times, and I've heard a speech elsewhere. And I was struck by the speech in a way that we were carefully explained that Russia is not a European country. When somebody asked, Canada is a European country? Turkey is a European country? United States is a European country? Why Russia is not a European country? Well, there was no explanation. And then there was something about our coat of arms. Well, I could believe it, you know. He says, your speaker of the lower chamber, Mr. Rybkin, came to us and said that the coat of arms of Russia is a double-headed eagle. Well, and so what? No, but double-headed ego has two heads. One head looks in the wrong direction. So you're not European. And you understand that after hearing that Eastern European countries should be integrated into NATO, but with Russia there should be cooperation. Well, I don't know English as well as probably some people, but I understand that there's some difference between, you see, some people are integrated, and with other you cooperate. And cooperation is a very, very wide and vague notion. And you understand that we have a lot of people in Russia who also would like to cooperate, not to integrate. All these thousands of generals, army of more than 2 million people, military sector, Mr. Zhirinovsky, many, many other people who, hearing this speech, will say, okay, what's this happening? Russia is living in Sweden. Japan has reconsidered its military policy. We have China, which is still a communist country. We have Central Asia with the fundamentalism on the rise. We have Northern Caucasus on fire. And then we have NATO, which is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Against whom? Against whom NATO should be growing? Is it against Moldova? Well, I guess the answer is very obvious. It's against Russia. And any liberal in Russian parliament would immediately vote for increased military spending if such things happened. And I don't see why Russia cannot be integrated, because I think some Europeans would like to see America more balanced, Germany more balanced, and probably to have a really global security system which is looking forward, which is not a satellite of the United States. Because when I hear some of our brothers from Eastern Europe, the Slav compatriots, speaking this, how good it is that the American forces are in the Central Europe and they should be there. We don't like them yet. Well, we somehow don't like it. And it's clear that the real end of the Cold War will be, then there will be even no question of confrontation. Then there will be no question against whom is NATO. When there will be a nice situation when our generals will be sitting somewhere in Brussels drinking coffee together with NATO generals, discussing how to make a very efficient army in Russia of, I don't know, 700,000 or 1 million. When they will be cooperating, instead of still in military colleges, well, they're discussing who could be the probable opponent in the war. And I think it's in the interest of everybody. If we are not compatible, let's say, which are the criteria for compatibility. But don't say that we are not European. Because obviously, over the last 1,100 years, we thought that we are European. And even if Mr. Ruhe doesn't believe it, and especially that we had so many Germans in Russia, and half of our nobility was always German, and we can we have, I don't know, a million Germans even now. So this is stupid. And I think that this is short-sighted position which will not lead anywhere. And I'm interested in participation in NATO or even thinking about this idea, because ultimately it will help democracy in Russia. Because when you are in an international organization, your moves inside the country have to be weighed on the balance, on the just from the point of view of what will be the direction of your partners. Will they look at it as a normal decision, or it will be considered outrageous, for instance? And the best help the West could do us from time to time to call Mr. Yeltsin and to tell him that some things are outrageous. No, Helmut calls Boris and says, hey Boris, good morning. The thing you've just done is outrageous. Don't do it again, please.
Thank you. I'll just take Tony Payne to say a word.
Just before we end, I'd like to ask Tony Faint, who is the head of the Know-How Fund, which is doing such great work in Russia, to say a word. It's also supporting our cause here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard, and thank you, Boris, for that very entertaining and stimulating talk. I think that if anybody got the idea from this talk that Boris is pessimistic about the future of Russia, they couldn't be more wrong. I've always found him to be a great optimist in all our contacts since we were together in the EBRD, when one also needed to bear up against some certain trying circumstances, although on a smaller scale. And I think that one thing that I certainly took from everything that that Boris said today was it does highlight the importance of transferring the knowledge and skills of the market and the knowledge and skills of the democratic system to Russians and to other people in the former Soviet Union. And that's basically why the Know-How Fund is so happy to be a financial contributor to the LSE Banking and Finance course for Russia. We very strongly support the idea of capable young Russians being exposed to high-quality teaching here in London, and that for a comparatively longer period than is possible with the LSE's successful summer schools. It's always gratifying to see a good idea become a reality, and the good idea for this course, I think, basically came from Boris Fyodorov, I'm sure that he's very happy to see these very capable young Russians here in London on this course, and we are very grateful to him for coming along and giving this talk in order to highlight the course. I might mention that this course is a complement to some other things that the Know-How Fund is doing with Russia in the financial services sector. I know that the LSE have formed links with the Chancellor's financial sector scheme, and I think it would be worth encouraging participants on this course to consider whether they might be able to participate in this other great idea from our Chancellor of the Exchequer, the idea of work placements with British financial institutions. Well, the financial sector in Russia is certainly a challenging area to work in. I don't know whether the British TV series Monty Python has reached Russia yet. One of the sketches that I saw recently repeated showed an accountant considering a career in lion taming, but opting for a safer option in banking. Well, in Russia, I think that on balance, lion taming might have been the more conservative choice. But what is undoubtedly true is that financial sector development is crucial to Russia's further progress towards a well-functioning market, and the Know-How Fund intends to continue to support it strongly. And I hope that the participants in this course will return home to play a major role in the Russian economy's financial sector for many years to come. Thank you very much, Boris, and thank you, Richard, for organising the course and organising this occasion. Many thanks.